Thank you, Chair. In the morning we had an interesting debate, and there were some points raised regarding multilateral liberalization versus plurilateral or regional liberalization. What I noticed was that there was full-throated support for multilateralism or multilateral liberalization in the very impressive keynote address from Bharatiya Sung. Apart from that, we heard Mr. Rahman coming out in full support of the multilateral trading system in general, and of multilateral liberalization in particular. But some other speakers were a bit ambiguous about how much support they extended to multilateral liberalization and the multilateral trading system. And in this regard particularly, I was worried when I heard that at least one major player, in one major player, there is a diminishing support for the molecular trading system. Now, not that this comes as a surprise, but I had thought that the way this was panning out was that the United States was more supportive of initiatives like the TPP, and it had not declared itself against the multilateral trading system or against the WTO system. But the way I think it is developing is that the business community is withdrawing in support from the multilateral trading system, which is something very disappointing. And this is something to which Ambassador Sun has also referred, and he has sort of very rightly expressed concern in this regard. Now, this presentation on NAM is predicated on the assumption that everyone wants to conclude the negotiations, which are taking place on a multilateral basis. Therefore, we do not sort of take up that question again, what was the more general question that was taken up in the morning. Although I do refer to it later. Now, participants would recall that tariff negotiations have formed the backbone of successive rounds of GATT and WTO negotiations in the past. And in this one also, the current Doha round also, although non-agricultural tariffs made a late entry because it was not a part of the built-in agenda as agriculture and services were. But I think thereafter the participants began attaching a lot of importance to it. And one of the reasons for which there was some sort of stalling of the Doha round in 2008 was related to the NAMA negotiations, and that was the issue of whether the emerging countries should compulsorily or mandatorily be asked to subscribe to the sectoral initiatives against the agreement that had been in evidence in Hong Kong ministerial declaration, in which it was specifically stated that subscribing to sectoral initiatives will be a voluntary exercise, as indeed it had been in the previous negotiations. So with this as the background, let me take you through my 11th slide presentation, and then maybe we can come back for some discussion. I have been asked to speak about not NAMA in general, but NAMA negotiations as they are related to the major developing countries. So I take up only this aspect of the negotiation. There are two NAMA proposals, main NAMA proposals, which are of interest are concerned to the major developing countries. The Swiss formula that they applied on the basis of the comprehensive product coverage with a lower coefficient for developed and a range of coefficients for the developing member. And the second one is something to which I just referred, is the proposal for reduction, harmonization or elimination of tariff in identified sectors. What are the major interests of these developing economies in the non-monetization? First of all, they want flexibility to either keep a certain number of tariff lines unbound or apply to them cuts that are lower than the formula. And the second important point was that they wanted that full account should be taken of the autonomous liberalization that they had undertaken, particularly after the negotiations were launched in September 2001. And their important assertion or important point was that as far as sectoral initiatives are concerned, joining them should be a voluntary exercise. Now, the chairman proposals, which are at present in the in the draft, which is before the participant in negotiation, which we should everyone refers to as Rev 3, does envisage flexibility for exclusion of a certain number of tariff lines from binding commitments, as well as for applying lower than formula cut, just as some of the major developing countries have been wanting. However, the chairman had done a very clever thing. He had designed the proposals in such a way that that it encourages the minimum utilization of these flexibilities. And another element was that for unbound tariffs, the base rates were to be established on the basis of a non-linear markup of 35 specific points on MFN applied rates as on 14 November 2001. Now, I have gone into the specific on this because of a point that is raised by particularly US businesses and was reiterated by Dick in the morning about what is known as the difference between the bound and the applied rates. Now, you will notice that the chairperson has said that the base rate would be the applied rate that was MFN applied rate that was valid on 14 November 2001. In other words, if there has been a reduction in those rates subsequently, that would be taken into consideration. Now, what are the developing countries' arguments against doing more than what the applying the formula that has been proposed? In India, Brazil and some other emerging economies, there is a large gap between bound, this is developed country arguments against asking the developing country to do more. In India, Brazil and some other emerging countries, not including China, there is a large gap between bound and applied emission tariffs. The binding overhang is a source of unpredictability in tariff regime, so they say. This is the argument. Where the bound rates are higher than applied rates, reduction of tariffs under the formula will not result in improved access to them in meaningful commercial terms. What they say is that businesses are not interested in reduction of bound rates unless the applied rates also come down. Now these are the arguments being given. Now, what is the position of the major developing countries on these points that are being raised? What they say is that in gas before WTO and in WTO, tariff negotiations, the bound level constitutes the basis of the negotiations and not the applied level. At the end of each negotiating round, balance is struck in the interest of each member on the basis of specific commitments on boundaries. In India's case, and there is a particular point that indeed, there is a big difference between the bound rates and the applied rates. But much of this is the consequence of a steep reduction of duty undertaken unilaterally and autonomously after the Doha round was launched. I laid stress on the point in the chairman's text that the base rate was the applied rate as on 14 November 2001. And that is the point which India is stressing. And just to give an example, the average applied tariff, MFN, simple average, of India was 35% in November 2001. Rather high, but so it was. Today the average, simple average is around 10%. Having been reduced successively almost every year between 2002 and 2008. And it is at a level which results in a simple average. Now, what the US businesses and the US negotiators are saying, and I have heard in the US representatives and others also say the same thing, is that, well, what you have received reduced from 2001 onwards is autonomously, it is on your own. Now we find that it is much lower than the bound rate, and if you now reduce the bound rate, there will not be much difference because we are already getting this. This is the point that they are making. And they are saying that we want commercially meaningful access. By which they mean that if you have reduced the applied rate much below the bound rate, then that doesn't concern us. Because we are already getting the benefit of this applied rate, and we want it to be commercially, and in order for it to be commercially meaningful, you must go below that 10% or whatever. So, in this slide, I am raising some of those questions. So what exactly is this commercially meaningful? Traditionally, WTO and GATT negotiations have resulted in incremental improvement in access and not big bang changes in applied tariffs. This is the traditional situation. Since the bound MFN tariffs in major developed countries are already very low, it may be equally argued that application of the proposed formula will also not yield anything commercially meaningful on a vast majority of tariff lines for the trading partners. I calculated by applying the, made calculations by applying the formula to the average of most of the major countries, which is around 4%. It is the median. In some cases it is 3. Now if the Swiss formula is applied to 4% with a coefficient of 8, with the chairman's proposal, then it will bring down 8% to 2.67%, 4% to 2.67%. Now, may I ask if that is regarded as commercial meaningful? In India, the average applied tariffs have been brought down from 35 to 10% after the negotiations commenced. My question is it fair to ask India to make further reduction to make improved access commercially meaningful? Now, it is often stated that, in fact, this is a point on which many European countries have been laying stress. It used to be called non-reciprocity, but now it's known as less than full reciprocity. Is less than full reciprocity in trade negotiation the issue for major developing countries? What is stalling the NAMA negotiation? Now, may I just explain that in the GATT-WTO tariff negotiation, the standard technique used among equal trading partners is reciprocity, measured on the basis of trade coverage multiplied by the depth of production. Now, GATT 1994, as well as the Doha Ministerial Regulator, commit members to less than full reciprocity in trade negotiations between developed and developing countries. However, and this is an important part, if the Swiss formula is applied as proposed, in actual fact, the major developing country members would be ending up with full reciprocity, not less than full reciprocity. Far removed from the concept of less than full reciprocity. This is not the issue. Less than full reciprocity is not the issue. What developing countries, the major developing countries, want to avoid is that they are not compelled to offer more than full reciprocity. Now, I go back to the major point of discord between the major developing countries and the developed countries. If developing countries are also required to undertake reduction on a sectoral basis, there would be a reciprocity deficit again. I just now mentioned that whereas the Doha Round Declaration commits members to give to developing countries or to developed countries to ask for less than full reciprocity, what the Swiss formula will result will be in full reciprocity, not less. And what adherence to the sectoral initiatives will result in will be a reciprocity deficit. Not even full reciprocity. Elimination of duty on a sectoral basis can result, this is the other point. This is not the only point, the reciprocity deficit. The other point is that when tariffs are being reduced, it is better economically, more meaningful. It makes economic good sense. If you reduce tariffs across the board, for this reason, personally, I am not in agreement with the proposal of India and others that they should be given the flexibility to keep some tariffs out from the negotiations. That is not economic good sense. That is political economy, because they must protect some sector. So equally, reducing tariffs more, eliminating than the rest, doesn't make good sense, economic good sense. It results in inverted tariff structure, as has happened in the case of information technology agreement, to which India adhered, but it has suffered. Before developing countries agree to eliminate tariffs in any sector, they need to be given time. This is the third reason. They need to build world-class infrastructure, including transport infrastructure, and bring about changes in land, labor, taxation law in order to become competitive. Further, what applies more, why emerging countries are opposed to making any more concessions than what the application, the formula like. I'm giving another reason, which I think it is a very correct reason. China completed its accession negotiations in 2001. That was the year in which the new negotiations were launched. And China had made very substantial reductions in that. So, It is unfair to ask them to do anything more.
Next one.
Okay.
What is the outlook for NAMA negotiations after Bali? While most delegations are willing to work on the basis of the current text, the US has maintained the stand that all issues should be discussed afresh. For most members, a fresh chemical exercise to construct alternative modalities is an unacceptable proposition. They have worked for at least 7 years between 2001 and 2008 in order to arrive at the present situation. Now, when I discussed with some of them, why not change the coefficient for distance, there was an immediate reaction of horror from those people. However, what I gather from what is happening in Geneva is that there is a general sense that members may seek to lower the level of ambition in this area as in other areas. And the new buzzwords are recalibration and doing what is doable. There was a suggestion that negotiations for liberalization in all the three groups could be based on a request of a procedure. But this did not get much traction. There is also a suggestion that was, I think, mentioned by Ambassador soon in the morning, that was average cuts. Now, this being the background, what is my suggestion on the way forward? I think we are working at think tanks, and the think tank should always be not repeating the arguments. I have repeated the arguments of the two sides, but that is essential in order to logically deduce what should be the way forward. It is apparent that if Doha round is to be concluded speedily, the number of issues needed to be reduced. Now, I just now said that there was a general thinking about recalibration and lowering the level of ambition. My suggestion to the think tank is that it is not the level of ambition that should be lowered, but only the scope of negotiations. In this NAMA, there is also a huge lot of non-tariff measures which are being considered. Well, one or two of them are likely to be very easily sort of accepted, but there are others which are more difficult. Now, the benefit of that will not be commensurate with the amount of labor that will have to go into. So the suggestion that I have is that let the next 2-3 months, July is something the new date. Perhaps by the end of the year, ministers, in that period to tackle those 10 or 11 NTBs will not be possible. But political decisions on the tariffs are possible because they are well thrashed up. So this is the third point that I have. Is that in the context of proliferation of regional and major regional agreements, what the world needs is a big dose of multilateral trade liberalization in the world. I am assuming that everyone is interested in restoring the multilateral trading system and strengthening. If that assumption is correct, then this is a good recommendation. That, you know, what happens, what is the regional agreement, these major regional agreements, like multilateral agreements, also result in liberalization? but partial liberalization. And the regional agreements advance the interests of the parties, but they hurt the interests of the non-parties. And every agreement has non-parties, unlike multilateral. So that's why the concern is there regarding regional agreements. So what is the best way of dealing with this situation? Best way is that give a big dose of multilateral liberalization, thereby bring erode the preferential advantage of the preferential agreements, so that the preferences do not have that much of a sting for those who are not participating. And for that, only what is being suggested is that don't lower the level of ambition. Keep the Swiss formula. Keep the coefficients as proposed. Don't lower that. What needs to be lowered is the scope of ambition. In fact, what is being suggested is that the current round should be speedily closed, concluded, and should be followed up by another ambitious round, so that the emission tariffs on non-agricultural products are reduced even further, and the adverse effects of regional and mega agreement for non-participants is minimized. And here's the suggestion that I am making, further suggestion for the consideration of the think tank. This is a small group. Since the major area of discord is acceptance of elimination of tariffs in certain sectors, negotiations should be centered on this area. And in the political decision, this will not take much time. And the suggestion is that the major developing countries should consider joining sectoral initiatives in at least three sectors proposed by the USA and EU. And these are chemicals, industrial machinery, and gems and jewelry. All other sectors could be taken up on the basis of acceptance by a critical mass of members. To make it easier for the major developing countries to consider joining these initiatives, what I have suggested, the principal sectoral modality should be not zero for zero, but zero for X, as suggested in the REF 3. And I am suggesting this because in order to meet the criticism that I have explained, that if you select an area for steeper reduction, that creates opportunities for inverted tariff structure and distortions which are not in the interest of the economy. So in order to meet that, at least allow them to have 5%. At least the major developing economies, India, China, and Brazil, they have tariffs on industrial machinery, so they are going to gain also in other way. And then the last proposal is that all the proposals related to tariffs should be included in the package, except the NTBs. And that includes everything. There are several groups for which a special dispensation has been given, including LDCs. LDCs are being sort of given the major advantage that they will not have to make any contributions whatsoever. And in addition, there is this quota-free, duty-free, as well as making, alleviating the effect of reduction of tariff on their preference. Everything is there. And I don't think there is a major difficulty, political difficulty that any major group has. So I suggest that I think this should also, all the proposals that are there in the REP 3 document can be accepted by the participants in the Dwara. Thank you.
Thank you, Prana Prabhupada, for a very illuminating presentation. I'm sure there will be plenty of questions in the presentation. Over to you, Dick.
I had prepared a PowerPoint, but in a classic Dick Cunningham error of tactical delivery, I gave essentially all of my PowerPoint in my earlier discussion today in another section of this roundtable. I will revert to some of the points, and I have copies of the PowerPoint if anybody wants it. What I'd like to do is talk a bit about Anwarl's really interesting presentation. I have to say I'm in a very curious position of having very serious disagreements with major elements of his logic and almost total agreement with all elements of his conclusions. I'm not sure what that says about trade or about my logic. But let me talk about this for just a second. If you go back to the earlier slides that Anwarl was using, and you talk about things like the fairness of asking certain countries to do certain things, you ask about the question of should countries get credit for tariff reductions that they have done voluntarily. I ask myself, what are we trying to accomplish here? Are we engaged in Aristotelian logic? Are we engaged in a social fairness exercise? Or are we doing something in terms of accomplishing an economic goal? And if we're accomplishing an economic goal, what is that economic goal? I have always thought that when one talks about trade liberalization in general and tariff reductions in particular, what one is trying to do is reach an agreement in which countries agree to take actions that maximize world benefits and their own country's economic benefits. And that from that standpoint, you make tariff reductions if you think those are good things to do for those purposes. It always struck me that it's not particularly fruitful in a discussion within a trade negotiation to talk about things like what I would call the I gave at the office principle. You know, people come around and say, I want you to donate to the Red Cross. And you say, no, I gave at the office. Meaning you already made voluntary tariff reductions. The question is, in a negotiation, as to any requested or any proposed tariff reduction, is it a beneficial thing to do? And in the overall negotiation, what you are trying to do in general is to reduce tariffs so as to increase trade flows, with the limitation on that being that where such reductions would cause harm to a particular country of a type that the trading system doesn't believe should be caused, then you limit the tariff, then you could agree to let that country limit its tariff reductions. One of the concerns I have about the fairness arguments is that it assumes that what is fair for me to do is, well, let me try another way, is that it assumes that I am doing something to my country's disadvantage when I reduce my tariffs. Putting aside a situation in which you have a particular vulnerability in terms of your people's welfare, it always seemed to me that has very little to do with the trade negotiation. That a trade negotiation seeks to maximize economic welfare. And that any trade negotiation starts with the proposition, whether it is a negotiation in which you believe, remember when I talked earlier today, there are sort of two types of approaches to trade negotiations. One is in which everybody has a consensus that liberalization of trade is, subject to certain exceptions, a beneficial thing, and we're all going to try to achieve the maximum liberalization through this negotiation. A consensus that seems certainly not to exist in the current WTO membership to the extent that it did back in the old GATT days, because you have countries in different economic situations, and I understand that. Or you can do horse trading. But whether you do horse trading or you do it from consensus, the question is, it seems to me, in the negotiation, what are you asked to do to change your current situation? And what is another country to gain from you changing your current situation? And what are you to gain or lose from that? That's why I have trouble with the I gave the office problem. I understand that the political and emotional power of saying, but we already reduced voluntarily, why do you want to make us reduce more? Putting aside for a moment the assumption of that, that reducing more is something that's to my disadvantage. It is a negotiation that starts at the current reality and seeks to improve the welfare benefits by changing that current reality. There clearly, it seems to me, is a role for forms of special and differential treatment. My assumption is, my own working assumption myself, is that special and differential treatment is in the context of a trading system that seeks to maximize global benefits, better dealt with in terms of time allowed for the implementation of concessions, including tariff reductions, rather than so much a dispensation we don't have to make tariff reductions or we have to make lesser tariff reductions. I understand that some of that, however, is also appropriate and politically necessary in the WTO system. Where am I going with all of this? Where I'm going with all of this is to say it seems to me that the situation of the WTO has changed from a time in which you could apply the pretty pure terms, the type of logic that I have been saying you can apply, to a time in which, because there is a majority of the WTO, a large majority of the WTO, consisting of developing countries and indeed least developed countries, that you need to apply more in terms of special and differential treatment, in both of the types that I have discussed. There is, however, the problem that gradations and distinctions are not made by the system now among various developing countries. We've all talked about the horrible term graduation. I don't want to get into that debate. But you have countries, India being one of them, which in certain areas of trade, and certainly China being one of them even more, in many areas of trade, in which they are substantial players in trade, both players in terms of their being substantial markets, and players in terms of them being substantial exporters. Yet, at the same time, they have portions of their economy and particularly large portions of their popularity, of their populace, that have vulnerabilities that developed countries simply do not have. And the system has never learned. One of the problems with the Doha Round is that we've now come to a point where the failure to make those distinctions is seeming to the developed countries as something that prevents any significant further liberalization, and particularly in NAFTA, prevents any significant further liberalization. And that is why you have developing countries saying, and I don't think the developing countries care a whole lot about imposing on the least developed countries any significant tariff reductions. I suppose there may be some political imperative to say, well, everybody contributed something, but that's a fairness thing of the type that I just said. I don't particularly think is a good thing to inject into trade negotiations. I think we should be dealing economics here, not fairness, and economics in the terms of protecting only those interests that need to be protecting and liberalizing for the rest to the extent that we can get benefits from globalization. Having said all this, let me first tell you where I think the United States is in this area of NAMA. And then let me talk a little bit about, and you'll be surprised to hear how much I agree with Amaro, as to what is the likely way, what is the possible way forward here. The United States view, as best I can understand it, is that it's not going to accept a round result. Let me pause for that. It will not accept a full-blown round result. I'll explain to what I mean by that. That doesn't have substantial liberalization from the state of liberalization that exists today. In other words, the United States is going to be very reluctant as to the major developing countries, not forget about the least developed countries, to accept a deal which, as to most or all of the range of NAMA categories, simply eliminates part, maybe not even all, of the war, and does not produce a reduction in applied tariffs, and thus an increase in market access. And the question for the United States would like to have a negotiation in which, essentially, let's talk about what we trade for that. What we, because the United States is now looking at this as a horse trading exercise with the major developing countries. Don't take me as talking about the least developed countries. That does not necessarily mean the United States wants across the board liberalization of everything. It would take what it can get, particularly in the context that we're in now. The United States also, I think, would accept the proposition that Amaro said when he discussed the extent to which application of a formula to the current developed country tariffs only gets them reduced from 4% to 2.67% and poses the question, is this a significant liberalization? And I think the United States would say no. And the United States would then say what we would be prepared to do if we have a real negotiation would be to address things that are about the tariff peaks. Tough for the United States, but if we get reductions in applied tariffs on the other side, worth doing. and cross trades, and I think for the United States, the position of the developed countries are in now, cross trading between NAMA and agriculture, and probably between NAMA and services, which is something nobody really talks about very much. But I think my own view may actually be more promising as an area of cross concessions. But we've never gotten to that in the Doha round, and it's probably too late to get to that in the Doha round now. And so where I come to in the United States position is that the United States has gone off and done something else, but it's to its advantage, and for the moment, it's not hearing anything that gives it an incentive to do anything more than the current state of play in the Doha round and NAMA, and maybe even not to accept what now stands in the Doha round and NAMA. I must say, can you put up the last slide that you had there, the slide about the what should we do to move forward here? The last slide. What is the way forward? You just passed it. Go back.
Yeah.
What needs to be done? I think the United States, this is one of the two approaches the United States would probably accept as a way of completing the Doha round. One thing the United States is probably thinking is the only thing it can accept is what I call the Senator George Aiken formula. The United States was at one point in our history involved in a morass, a quagmire in Southeast Asia in the War of Vietnam. Every juncture of that war, it looked as if, well, if we put a little more resources in it, maybe we can win this, but we never did come close to win it. And finally, a brilliant senator from Vermont, George Aiken, said there is an easy way to resolve all this, and that is to declare victory and leave. And I think the United States could come pretty close to accepting something like that as a resolution for NAMA and the Doha round. They would have more problems with the current state of play in agriculture because of their agriculture bill. But this sort of thing here gives the United States, I think, the sort of thing that the United States would be attracted to. I know the Europeans would be attracted to this. I think I'm not entirely sure of the sectors that you choose there. Chemicals and industrial machinery certainly sound reasonable to me. My wife would shoot me if I opposed trade liberalization in gems and jewelry. So I think something like that for developing countries, for the major developing countries, with nothing significant required of the LDCs, makes a lot of sense. I also think zero for zero, while the United States talks a lot about that, is, I think, beyond hope. And whether it's 0 for 5 or 0 for 3 or 0 for 8 or whatever it is, makes a lot of sense to me. And even then, there may be gradations in terms of the least developed countries versus maybe the least developed countries. Go ahead.
They're out of the whole thing.
They're out of the whole thing. Probably the U.S. could accept that. I'd want to think about the NTBs, because I think there are a couple of things in NTBs that you could continue to do. But it doesn't matter, Hill and Beans, in terms of the economic impact. So here's the question for me, it seems, on the NAMA negotiations. Can we accept the fact that we really are in a ball game where the parameters are we could do something with this as the sort of maximum ambition that's feasible. And the George Aiken declare victory and leave as the minimum ambition believable. And then do so, and I think this is an absolutely essential point for the trading system as a whole. Do so only on an understanding that we're going to move to further negotiations to deal with other issues and to find a way to revive the primacy and stewardship of the WTO in the multilateral system. That's a package that works. It's a package that may be all we can do. And I have lots of trouble with people, what's going on with the effort now in Geneva to monkey around with coefficients and things like that, to try to fine-tune things in a way that takes exactly what's on the table now and says, okay, that's what, that we'll do this, because the developed countries aren't going to buy that. The only other approach than this, it seems to me, would be to do more cross-sector, that is, trade-offs between NAMA and agriculture and services. My problem with that is, if you're trying to do anything in the next year or the next 2 years, I think that's probably not feasible. I think it might be a desirable thing to do, and in the long run, we're going to have to start doing that in trade negotiations, but I think that's probably not feasible. And finally, let me emphasize that it seems to me your proposal here poses more difficulties to and more resistance from major developing countries than it does from the United States and Europe. That's not because you're not a good Indian, not because you're an American citizen in disguise. It's because I think the nature of it. But I think it recognizes that by including the sectoral initiatives in here, at least in part, it recognizes the necessity of having some result that the United States administration can take to its Congress and say we have actual access improvement. Because absent that, I think the United States cannot agree to anything in the resolution of the Doha round. And I am concerned about that aspect of the dynamic of what you propose. And I'm concerned because of the roundtables that we have had, particularly in Brazil and in South Africa, in which I suspect in Brazil and South Africa, probably more Brazil than South Africa, but tough call. The idea of having some sectoral negotiations to something like 0 for 5 is going to be really, really resistant. And in that regard, let me come back to what I said earlier. It seems to me that one of the problems that you have in the dynamic that now exists in trade negotiations is that the major developed countries now have a fairly uniform position. That is, they have moved to the mega regionals and the non-multilateral, the plurilaterals on TISA and the technology and the environmental and all of that. There is not among the major developing countries the kind of coordination, the kind of even effort to think out among themselves what as a group they remember, these are the bunch that say, well, we are a group, we're the BRICS, we're gonna have a BRICS bank, we're gonna do things together. I've even taken Peter to task for South Africa supporting India in the food security proposals. Taken to task because what I see South Africa doing there is opting for BRICS solidarity as opposed to its own economic interest. But having said all of that, there is no solidarity in terms of developing a position or even trying to coordinate a position, and I'd suggest that's because they have no real leadership among the major developing countries. And I will turn to the Chinese representatives here and look you in the eye again and say, I'm looking at you, fellows, because I don't see anybody else who could begin to start putting that leadership together. So that is my act here. I must say I think that's an excellent job you've done, Anuala, in putting together what might be a possible solution to it. And I would hope that we can get from here to there.
Thank you. Before going to the topic of this afternoon, I would like to add some comments to the discussion in the morning. Both Vera and Professor Wang mentioned that the world has changed a lot, especially after 2008 global financial crisis. I believe all have noticed these changes. The problem is many are not ready for accepting these changes. Ambassador Sun said that the time when U.S. make rules and others follow has gone. But I'm afraid the U.S. is not ready to admit that. That is one reason why the U.S. initiated the TPP or TISA, where the U.S. is still comfortably making rules and others are followed. That is also the case with regard to AIIB. The U.S. never imagined that its allies, except Japan, will ignore U.S. warnings. Before that, the U.S. did not want to give more shares to China and India in the IMF. And on the other side, China and other emerging economies are not ready for their new roles in the global governance either. They are used to waiting for the leadership or contributions from developed countries. They are not so sure about what they could do or how they should transform the global economic governance to meet with their own benefits through their own contributions. I think we all need time and education to adjust ourselves to changes. So do these governments and leaders. So I believe think tanks and scholars like us should educate our governments to understand and accept the new world and adapt to the new changes rather than sticking to the old thinking and doing. And of course, the significance of the WTO under the new circumstances. These are my to the morning discussion. Now, this afternoon, I will talk something about China's position in NAMA negotiations. We all know that China now is the biggest trading nation in the world. It means that merchandise trade is very important to China, and China is very important to the world merchandise trade. Especially since the WTO accession, China's merchandise trade has been developing very fast. We can have a look at this with chart. And also, it's been increasing very fast. And also, China has been enjoying trade surplus continuously and resulted in mounting foreign exchange reserve. We can have a look at this. Now it's slowing down, but still, it's a very huge exchange reserve. Trade is also very important to China. Trade GDP ratio in 2011 to 2013 is as high as 51.4%. And also China's share in world total export is 12%, while that in imports is 10%. And especially China's share in industrial goods trade is as high as 15%. So you can see that seemingly merchandise trade is very important to China, and China should be very positive in promoting trade liberalization in merchandise trade. But the position of China in non-negotiations in the Doha Round has not been so positive as we expected or imagined or supposed to be. Basically, especially in the early years of the Doha Round negotiation, China was very quiet or maybe not so active in our negotiation. Especially, China insisted its defensive interests, such as the new acceding member status and equal treatment with other big developing countries. So sometimes some people say that China is an elephant hiding behind the ants. I think they are not ants. in our negotiations, China has submitted only a few proposals. At the same time, China refused to take part in technical initiatives we discussed. But on the other side, China also did not join NAMA 11 or sided with developed countries. So China has a very unique position in NAMA negotiations, not siding with anybody. So China looks like isolated a little bit. So why is this case? Why so defensive? I will try to find some reasons behind that. The first reason is China really has been made ambitious commitments in tariff reductions and the non-tariff measures in its WTO accession negotiations. So that is a very big reason for China to refuse further ambitious commitments in the Doha Round. The second reason is there is no water between China's bound tariff and applied tariff. So that is also a major reason. I would say maybe the biggest reason is the concerns about China's international competitiveness. Maybe it seems a little strange because, as I said, China is the biggest exporter and the biggest trading nation. But China does have some sectors with little, maybe international competitiveness. You can see China has in 2013. China has a 70 billion debt in chemicals, trade deficit, and 115 debt in semiconductors, and 14 billion in medical devices.
U.S. dollars?
Yeah, U.S. dollars. In the IPA expansion negotiations, we can see these covered products. In these covered products, China also has 66 billion trade deficit. Of course, the U.S. also has that, but the EU and Japan have a big surplus. In medical devices and instruments, China also has a big trade deficit. So, I all understand that no country can be competitive on all products. It's a basic economic rationale. But for these relevant industries, they are really in need of more protection from the government to develop their own competitiveness. So every single sector will say their sector is the most important in the Chinese economy or in Chinese industrial development or industrialization or to get international competitiveness in the world. So for the government, they have their own difficulties to persuade these industries to accept further liberalization. Another side, why not so offensive enough or as we expect? Actually, many scholars, especially American scholars, how they say, China is the biggest beneficiary of non-negotiation results in the Doha. It is true, I think. But one issue is still half of China's exports are made by foreign invested enterprises. It's a little decrease, but still close to 50% of Chinese exports are made by foreign invested companies in China. And for these foreign invested companies in China, they are more concerned about Chinese own barriers, own trade barriers, rather than foreign barriers to Chinese exports. So they are not active to promote or lobby the Chinese government to pursue less trade barriers in other countries, in these importing countries. Another reason, another factor is Chinese SOEs, state-owned enterprises as a whole, have trade deficits. While private companies with less political influence have trade deficits. You can see in 2013, as Chinese SOEs have $250 billion trade deficit as a whole. Well, of course, foreign companies have public and private companies. But as I said, the problem is in the Chinese trade politics, private companies are not so influential. Or you can say only a few SOEs could influence the trade policy directly or significantly. Only these companies with very close connections with some important ministries. And again, foreign companies, especially the multinationals now in the era of global value chain, multinationals also pay less attention to border measures. If they have their own chains to dodge these border measures, border barriers, so it is not so important for multinationals. Then what does China really want in the Doha Round negotiation? As I know, China is satisfied with the municipal reform. It is good enough. So the Doha Round was initiated when China acceded to the WTO just in the same year. So the agenda was not made by China, or was not has no China's intention included in the agenda. So for China, I think as long as the Doha Round can be concluded, we are satisfied. No many demands or no many requests for China, that you bring the dogma. And for now, the top five markets for Chinese products are still Hong Kong, US, EU, Japan, and Korea, accounting for more than 60%. That's 10 years ago. There is no change in this, this issue. So, then China is currently in authority to force other developing countries to lower their tariffs. If they can lower, okay, it's better. But if they don't, especially if they don't lower their applied tariff, we don't care much about that. So if they can narrow the or reduce the water between applied and bond tariff, that is good enough. So I think China is not so hurry as the U.S. to reduce their actual market share in these big developed countries. But I would say, as I said, the importance of private companies in Chinese exports has been increasing. So, and for these companies, for these private companies, they will need these developing country markets more than these foreign companies. So I would say it is in China's interest to promote further liberalization of other emerging economies. And the WTO might be the only way to get this interest. What can China contribute? As I said before, I would say emerging economies should make more contributions to the WTO as well as the whole global economic governance. And for China, we have this space to make further liberalization. Actually, in the last slide, I show that there is no water between high and bond tariffs in China, but much water between collected and nominal duties. China's ratio of collected import duties to total imports is 2%. Close to 1.2% of US, 1.7% of Korea, and lower than, even lower than 2.1% of Australia. That means our tariffs are on paper, but not collected, really. Due to a lot of special initiatives like special economic zone, bonded areas, also pilot zone, something like free trade zone. So in this sense, we have space to lower our tariffs, our nominal tariffs. They are just on paper. We do not collect them. So why not to reduce them? I would suggest a grand bargaining between China's contribution in NAMA and some sectoral bilateral agreements, along with other emerging economies and the developed countries offering agriculture and other interests of developed countries, especially least developed countries, would be desirable. Of course, now many people say that if we stick to the old agenda of the Doha Round, the possibility of success is very, very low. But now, it is also very, very difficult to add new issues into the current agenda. So the best way is to build a balance on the basis of this current agenda. And under this agenda, maybe especially the emerging economies could be more brave to make more contributions, especially on now. From the experience of China's accession to the WTO, tariff reductions actually could help stimulate domestic industry competitiveness. There are a lot of evidences in automobile industries and in other many industries. So, of course, they have some concerns in certain industries, but the overall direction of tariff reduction would be helpful for the emerging economies to develop their own industry. Another suggestion is a lower standard Doha-round deal could be connected to an agreed future agenda on new issues or new approaches of future negotiation. Maybe it's not compulsory or binding, but if members, including both developed and the developed countries, can make some not commitment, but some agreements about the future negotiations would help to make the current deal. The last point is it is important to attract Chinese leaders' attention back to the WTO from other numerous initiatives. Our leaders are too busy. They have proposed a lot of initiatives which are not actually have not been discussed so thoroughly. As I said, we should educate our government and our leaders to come back to the WTO, which is well done to promote actually many of our objectives. Okay, I'll stop.
Thank you. We started the session about 40 minutes late, and with your permission, I'd like to propose that we move on to the tea session and then have a joint discussion session. If the professor is able. Otherwise, we will be very late if we go ahead. I'm trying to go to 5 minutes late. Is it possible for people to bring in their tea and coffee in there?
Yeah, okay.
So I suppose we have a 5 minute break. We bring your tea and coffee. We proceed to the tea presentation when we have a joint session. It's already 25 minutes before. So, yes, I'm trying to make sure that we get some
paper. And moral,
oh, yes.
If I could have your indulgence only for 1 or 2 minutes, because Dick had extensive responses to what I suggested, that it is only fair that I at least spend a minute or two.
Yeah, I told you I don't deal in fair.
you may, but Dick, you may not respond.
I will not respond.
Cool. Maximum 5 minutes. Those 2 turns to become 10. No, maximum 5.
Very briefly, I think the United States, like all other countries, is their sovereign right to come out with any proposal to advance its interest. But I have only 2 points, one or 2 points to make on this.
that the difficulty with the maintenance proposal of taking applied tariffs into account is that you are not helping international governance of treaties if you come out with the new proposals midway. The negotiations should proceed on the basis of the framework that has been agreed in the beginning. And if you have new points, then it is better to wait for another round of negotiation. So that's what my point is, that if you want to, the best way to help treaty making in general and trade liberalization in particular is to have negotiations on the framework that you have set, and then have another one bringing in new ideas, for instance, and taking into account the changes in circumstance, such as the fact that many developing, major developing countries are big traders, including China is the world's foremost trader. This is one point. The main point that I have on this issue. There is another point, but then for lack of time I will not press that. Just one point.
I have no disagreement.
Thank you. We may now break for tea. 5 minutes. We could have done 5 minutes. Please feel free to bring it.
因为我那时候是那个时候不好，说了后我那时候都不敢说，我说你看，然后没有小伙子，弄出个东西来，反正有点看差不多，行吗？然后没想到扔了你。哎，师长，对，没事，这个罗玉还跟我讲起。对，没有，我跟那是很好的朋友。
我来那个内参还跟我说，是谁让您认识？我们应该是面过，他看我，他说好，我给他，是那天说的，我说我说行啊，那你跟他照张照吧。他说好，我给他笑死了。你要不要？对，不是，因为我后来我跟他说了，我说他是把别人的地，如果我做出来再讨论。是，但我们这样是，是吧？是吧？是你们，哇塞！但是老师他，有
PPT 吗？坐在那儿，你坐这儿。你要 PPT 吗？我给你搞上。对，我坐在那儿讲。你要用什么？
我那个方式是，不是一个more than investor, more than investor.
Okay, we're the ones that the United States is the one that promotes back off for the investment in the United States, you know, whatever. So other than maybe something that has a real national security interest, such that you want to have a kind of domestic ownership. You should welcome for
对，关键现在的人真的能赚起来，对吧？所以说这种反过来方向赚的也不容易，对吧？所以说这种反过来方向赚的也不容易，对吧？至少是。
机构在向学的，去待在这边，包括调研的，我觉得像国外一样的话，就是说他们肯定会先，先，对，因为我们搞实务，我们搞理论，然后结合起来，
结合起来，
就是把第二块呢，我觉得就是说学的能力，
哎，没错，
现在呢就是有点
少了，
会少了。
对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对，他是人家，对 不一样。
对，
你一头马戏的，
这还有，
这形象也
蛮低的。
那个这个家庭上没有一点
人
性，还不是自然的，人家玩起来没有什么意思。
没有调整心
理，一样的。
Ladies and gentlemen, and Peter,
and Peter. You are in between. You are in between.
Which category?
Yeah.
Okay, when Yang will take over from here,
babe. Yeah, I will do the circus job. Thank you. Because for this session, we will focus on the Trade and Services Agreement, TISA, which is a very hot topic now. And we have a lot of questions to ask to ourselves. So how about the progress of the negotiation? What's the problem? What are the barriers? And what are the implications and impact from the TISA to the future WTO? So how to compare the impact of the mega regional FTA? So I think that is all the big questions we can see approach on the table. Now we have two distinguished speakers. The first one is Jing Xiaoshi, Dean of the Law School at UIBE, as you are here, and published a lot on the international trade law. And Dr. Bernard Oakman from the European University Institute based in Aten. I would like to say one thing that mention that. So one of your translated book called Book on WTO used widely in China. In my class on political economy of trade, I'm using your book for reference. Thank you very much.
Free of charge.
Now I'd like to invite Dr. Shi to speak. By the way, I would like to limit the major presentations to 15 minutes. That'll be enough. And then 15
minutes.
15 minutes. 1:05. All along. Long,
maybe longer.
And then open to
dialogue. Session will have 2 hours or
2 hours. Yeah.
But we'll have only two speakers.
Yes, yeah. So the of course you know you I think
okay,
you will feel free to
for 20 minutes.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Great bargaining.
Many thanks for your nice introduction to me. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you. It's my extreme honor to be here and share some views on trading services with you. Particularly, I noted there is another panelist in this session, Professor Bernard Hochmann. He's a bigger figure in this area because I have been reading his articles and books dating back to 1990s. So I'm finally, I met you today in person. Okay, first, the outline of my presentation, basically it's divided into several parts. First, introduction, and then I summarize the progress thus far for the TISA negotiation. And then I'm going to briefly talk about the US and TISA respectively and the China and TISA. Also some potential or new possible rules in TISA and the multilateralization of TISA will be discussed briefly as well, followed by conclusion. Okay, I think most of us understand why now TISA is being negotiated. Basically, it's because of the huge important role played by the service sector in terms of employer and global the amount in global GDP. Viewed from measured by traditional balance of payment method, trading services accounts for about 20% of world trade. But while measured by so-called value-added method, trading services already accounted for almost half of global volume of services trade. So we all know that GATT General Agreement on Trading Services, which was concluded in early 1990s, is outdated because of new phenomena, new development in world economy, particularly because of, you know, like the technological advances, changing business practice, due to global integration, global value chain, and so on. Okay, I think due to the time limit, I'm going to skip this one about the background. Okay, why it is now for TISA negotiation? Negotiation was launched in mid-2012. So-called a group of like-minded countries, really good friends of services, led by US, EU, and Australia. TISA is currently being negotiated with among 51 participants, with Uruguay very newly joined in December 2014. So now the TISA negotiating member accounts for almost 70% of the world trade in services. Twenty-four WTO members and 51 countries. But we, at the same time, we note which country is not participating, particularly for China and BRICS countries. This picture shows the current TISA parties on the world map. So far, 11 rounds. It's interesting to note different websites have different statistics. Some websites said it's 11 rounds of negotiation have been conducted, but according to the US website, 10 rounds of negotiation have been conducted. So, anyway, 4 rounds in 2013 and 5 in 2000, according to the US website. 5 in 2014 and 1. The next one will be next week. The latest, the 10th round took place during February 2015, led by the US, welcomed the joining of Uruguay as the 24th member. During the latest round, discussion focused on number of proposals, including transparency, domestic regulation, telecommunication, financial services, e-commerce, and the movement of natural persons, basically eight topics. As I said, the next round will be taking place next week. So this is a brief progress assessment. As I observe, I think peace negotiation unavoidably led to controversial between developed country and developing country, because half participants of peace negotiation are developed while another half are developing country. Not only developing countries face challenges in peace negotiation, the same applies to developed countries as well. For example, the U.S. Is also faced with some challenges, such as opening its market to foreign providers of maritime services, air transport services, Model 4 presence of natural persons, delivery, and even domestic regulation. So far, although TISA members have made considerable progress on finalizing provisions on the deal, but still there are a lot of so-called gray areas. In terms of market access, two parties to the TISA talks, Pakistan and Paraguay, are yet to submit their initial offers to their partner. So thus far, only 21 members had circulated their initial offers on market access commitment. So basically, for the U.S., TISA is a very important trade agenda, particularly for Obama administration. This is because the huge important role played by service sector in the U.S. Generally, services generate more than 75% of U.S. GDP and provide more than 80% of private sector jobs. U.S. is the number one services trade country, including importation and exportation. So TISA is indeed part of Obama administration's ongoing efforts, also together with TPP, TPIP, Triple T, to create economic opportunity for the U.S. workers and business by expanding trade opportunities. But the pending issue is whether Obama administration can get the TPA. For China's total volume of trading services, I got some recent statistics, but if you have time, for the 2013, for the first time, China's trading services realized double digits increase on an annual basis. So we can say this is 2013. You can compare China's services trade and this is the growth rate year on year. Okay, as we can say travel and the transportation are the two biggest service sectors in China for 2013. And other services, mainly business services, account more than one half. To conclude, China's trading services has been
That's a serious barrier. Intellectual property rights.
Sorry. In some services industry and the trade play a key role in upgrading Chinese economy in the new era. The statistics show that the great room for China, although as I have been showing the pictures, you can see there has been a lot increase in terms of trade volume for China's trading services. But the statistics also show that there is a great room for China to develop its services industry and the services trade. In fact, China has been implementing a series of measures, including 12th five-year plan and development for services industry, including launching Shanghai Free Trade Zone and also very recently in December 2014 last year, the State Council promulgated several important opinions for promoting trading services in China. The goal made in China is soon to be replaced by, served by China, but who knows when. In September 2013, China officially expressed its interest in joining TISA negotiations. But China has been experiencing very different fate compared to Uruguay. Uruguay was agreed to join, but China until now is still its uncertainty. translation is still pending. The largest opponent is the USA. The US provided 5 reasons that demonstrating that if China is not ready to join the TISA negotiation. So the bigger question is whether China is ready or not. We can also observe, actually, in there are some difference between U.S. government and industry. The latter seems to be more practical, willing to consider China's huge potential market and let China in. As we said before, China is not in TISA negotiation and BRICS countries are not either. Basically, for plurilateral agreements negotiated within WTO during the past 2 decades have generally covered what we call critical mass of trading partners. But now the question is how to define critical mass. Currently, TISA negotiators account for 70% of services trade. If BRICS countries, including China, are included, it might achieve 90%. So there is a possibility of redefining critical mass according to Mr. Hamid, the director of trading services at the WTO. Actually, I think what he means is so-called meaningful mass. If China is not there, to some extent, the negotiation might not be very meaningful considering China's huge potential services market. Or some scholars suggest use substantial coverage in that Article 5. All this relates to the methodology of multi-lateralizing TISA in the future. New possible roles. The framework is very similar with the GATT so that TISA can be easily incorporated into the multilateral system in the future. But in terms of commitment from GATT positive list to TISA's so-called hybrid list, which basically provides a kind of flexibility to its members. Market access applies positively, so while national treatment apply negatively. The same with current debt. The negative list approach implies that any new type of services that is developed after the agreement enters into force is automatically covered unless it is specifically excluded. So this is going to be a big challenge for many members because it concerns the capacity of lifting some areas you do not want to liberalize. Also, it might incorporate competitive and model neutrality, which means the services provider may freely choose to provide service either on cross-border basis or local commercial presence. This is basically relates to the question of forced localization. Uh, fact, model 4 liberalizes hampering movement, as I said previously, which is a big challenge for the United States. And stronger that discipline might be proposed, might be incorporated as well in terms of government procurement, competition policy, and regulatory coherence, and mutual recognition and domestic regulation. Also some disciplines beyond that, such as state-owned enterprise. But as far as I know, this topic is too sensitive to be negotiated right now. Removal of forced localization, because to a large extent this relates to data flow, cross-border data flow. So I think this is a strong interest that the U.S. has. Subsidies, question mark, and emergency feedback, also as far as I know, it's not being negotiated right now. TISA members are considering so-called early harvest plan, which covers financial services, telecommunication, e-commerce, movement of natural person transparency, and domestic regulation. So in conclusion, I believe a food international services agreement has the potential to create better trading conditions that enable service industry to achieve their full potential. That's why that is being negotiated. Can draw on best practice from around the world. It may establish new market access commitments and universal, more stronger rules that can reflect the trade rules in the 21st century. My core argument in this presentation is that TISA negotiations are currently taking place outside the GATT and the WTO framework. And China is absent from the negotiations, so are some important countries. The exclusive nature of TISA, which I think will weaken its position in further services liberalization. In recent decades, the importance attached by China to trading services and China's huge market, services market potential, make it clear that China deserves a place in TISA negotiation. So the U.S. Should change its attitude and support China to join the TISA negotiation as soon as possible. This not only does good to China-U.S. bilateral trading services, but also can lay a good foundation to the TISA to be multilateralized in the future. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Dr. Xu. And I invite Professor Donald Kuhlman.
Okay, so my presentation is very similar to Professor Xi's have a little bit of a different take on some issues, but that will also speed up the discussion so that we have time to talk. So, why do we have TISA? Basically because WTO negotiators screwed up. So I think a huge mistake was made, what I call here the original sin, which was to prioritize agriculture and NAMA and say, okay, first we'll deal with that, and then we'll deal with services. Down the road, that was an explicit decision that was taken, and I think it was a huge mistake, because what was done by doing that, especially because ag and NAMA didn't go anywhere fast, is that a very large proportion of the multinational business community kind of switched off because they really wanted to see progress made on services. So I think that's really why we have that TISA going on here, as Professor Xi took you through the history. You know, so the countries that really were very much interested in moving forward on services decided to kind of move this thing out of the WTO, so we're now at a very lateral negotiation ongoing. In a sense, the cover for that was given by the ministerial conference, starting in Hong Kong, saying, you know, start being a bit more creative about how we do these things. But I think the key thing to bear in mind here is that all of this is happening now outside the WTO, and the WTO secretariat is not even allowed into the room. So that's something I'll come back to, because I think that really is a problem. And as was also mentioned, you know, this is something that didn't really come from the US or the EU. Obviously, they supported it, but the original ideas and a lot of the kind of motivating work was done by Australia and some other smaller countries to move this forward. So we had a bunch of talks. As was mentioned, next week we're going to have the 11th round. We have 52 countries now negotiating this. And as was mentioned, we have Uruguay that we just allowed to join the discussion, and China, of course, which has yet to be accepted. Now, one of the things that I think is important to bear in mind in thinking about TISA is most of the countries who are involved in TISA already have preferential trade agreements with each other, which cover services. So if you do kind of an exercise to figure out how much is actually potentially on the table for the different countries, that varies enormously. So for some countries, there really isn't a whole lot there because they already have trade agreements with each other. And for other countries who are kind of new to this area, there is actually potentially a lot there. So think about countries like Pakistan, Turkey, because they don't have any preferential trade agreements with most, if not all, of the countries who are talking to each other in the TISA. And nobody has a preferential trade agreement with all of the big three, right? So the EU, Japan, and the US. So in that sense, there's something in it for everyone. And the basic idea originally, in terms of how you structure these negotiations, was to say, well, let's start by actually looking at what is the best treatment we're giving to anyone else in the context of the preferential trade agreement, and then extend that to everybody who is sitting around the table. Now, one of the implications of that, and again, we'll have to see how much happens, is that the focus is virtually completely, and depends on who you talk to, but the sense I get is that there's going to be no liberalization at all in terms of what is actually being done. It's all about lock-in, it's all about commitment, it's all about going through your schedules, what have you done with your most preferred partner, and then extend that to everybody else in TISA. So from a market access point of view, it's likely that nothing much is going to happen, except if you think there's value in making binding commitments, and there is a little bit of a cottage industry ongoing in the economics literature trying to figure out how do you actually go about thinking about what the value is of making commitments in services that basically only apply binding, which is actually quite difficult to do, much more difficult than it is for tariffs. And then there's the other side of it, which is these new and enhanced disciplines, the new rules that are being discussed for particular issue areas where, again, there might be some value added, and hopefully there will be some value added. So a number of issues, questions, kind of echoing what Professor Xi also was saying, is, you know, one big problem here, obviously, is that countries are talking to each other that already have been talking to each other. There are a few countries, like I mentioned, that haven't, but that means the net impact of TISA is going to be quite small, and the countries where you actually could get some traction, where they could see things happening, are not sitting around the table. So first and foremost, of course, that's China, which has expressed interest in participating in talks, but you also have India, you have Brazil, you have South Africa, you have basically the rest of the world, right? So there's essentially a large proportion of the more dynamic part of the world economy, the emerging economies, are not part of this discussion. So one question then is, insofar as we're not really talking about market access, fine, but we are talking about rules, you know, are those countries going to be inclined to accept those rules down the road when they have had no part in actually helping to negotiate and agree on what those rules should be? And I think here, I think it would be wise for some of the countries that are really actively pursuing the strategy of saying, let's keep countries out until we can agree amongst ourselves, to think about how successful that strategy was in the government procurement agreement, which of course is what was done many, many years ago, right? That started in the 1970s, and we still haven't seen much in the way of developing countries. The countries that weren't involved in the process originally of negotiating those rules for procurement have still not signed on. Right? So the countries that have joined the agreement have done that in the context of WTO accession, quite a bit of pressure to join in that context. Of course, that also applies to China. You can all tell us whether China is likely to join relatively soon. You know, I hear repeatedly positive sounds from the Secretariat. I've been hearing those for a long time. But I mean, it just shows that this is, and they have to renegotiate the agreement. Right, so the last iteration of the government procurement agreement was actually renegotiated in an effort to make it more acceptable and to make it more attractive to developing countries. But again, that was done in a way without the countries sitting around the table. Right, and if you read that new agreement, my reading of the new agreement is it's worse than the old agreement. Right, so they've actually tried to make it more attractive to what they think the developing countries might want, but at the same time, they've reduced the transparency, they've increased the scope to actually do stupid things in terms of policy. So it's certainly not, I think, an improvement, and we can come back to that, but obviously not the topic of the day. But I think the lessons from the GPA really should be internalized. So that's one. We have a lot of missing countries, and if the strategy is we need to get those countries in, it's not clear to me that this is the way to do it. Second kind of issue area, and this is really a big question, is TISA going to result in a lot of new discrimination? Right, and that depends a lot on how this agreement is going to be implemented. If it's going to be an Article 5 economic integration agreement under the GATS, then in principle everybody is free to discriminate to their heart's content. But the problem here is that it could be quite difficult to discriminate, right? So this is one of the open questions. So how much could be done, how much will be done that will actually apply discrimination? And I think here the market access side of the equation matters a lot. And if at the end of the day, really, this is only about locking in existing controls under GPAs and extending those to everyone else, there is not going to be a whole lot of discrimination in terms of applied policies associated with that process. So, and in principle, of course, insofar as we're going to start focusing on regulatory types of measures, regulation should in principle be non-discriminatory if you want to achieve a regulatory objective. So there again, there might not be necessary discrimination, but at the same time, anybody who's looked at how professional services are regulated will immediately conclude that there's a lot of protectionism associated with that process. So clearly there is scope for capture and there is scope there for discrimination on the market access side. But again, from what I can see and from what I hear, in the near term, there isn't going to be a whole lot happening there. Then the third question really is, can TISA be multilateralized and will it be? That, of course, is the big question, I think, here from our perspective about thinking about what this implies for the multilateral trading system. Now, I think there are, you can look at this as a glass half full and you can look at it as a glass half empty. If you look at the plus side of the equation, you know, in terms of thinking about TISA, at the very least, what it has done is it's created an opportunity for the countries that want to move on this and to really start talking about it to do so. Right? And I think that's very much a positive given that, you know, we're not seeing much happening on the multilateral level. So that's I would regard that as a positive. I think the other positive is it's going to help move towards greater convergence across all the PTAs that exist, right? Because if we're really talking about taking the best of what we've done with someone else and extending that to everyone else, at least there is a process where we're converging in terms of how countries are treated so that there is that positive dimension, which in a sense is multilateralization small time, right? So at least you're multilateralizing amongst the set of countries that are involved in the process. I think another plus side is that, you know, in principle, this is an open access agreement, and we could have a discussion as to whether countries would want to join if you haven't been part of the negotiation of the rules. But at least we're not looking at a closed regional agreement without an exception, etc. So whatever happens, I think they will have to have a mechanism so that countries can actually join, and then the negotiators have made that quite explicit that is what they're going to do. Another plus side from a multilateral perspective is that gas consistency has been kind of incorporated into the process. Right? So there was quite a bit of discussion when these things started, was to say, well, let's revisit the whole gas. The gas really doesn't work very well, the way it's structured, market access, national treatment, specific commitments, and so on and so forth. But at the end of the day, the people who argued we need to kind of ensure that what we do in TISA could actually be brought back to the WTO on the day. So in a sense, the structure of how this thing is going to be put together will make it feasible to actually put it back into the gas if that's what countries decide they want to do. So we have this, as was mentioned, shift from a positive list to a negative list for national treatment, but in a sense it's still consistent with the structure of the gas. So even if they go the Article 5 route, which is to make an economic integration agreement, you can incorporate whatever comes out of the TISA into the gas, including this whatever they do on the rules, because the gas includes an article which allows you to make additional commitments that we discussed before lunch, and which will allow that to be done. So in principle, multilateralization is feasible, and I think one of the things here to think about is, you know, that it could also become part of a Doha deal, right? So I think one of the things we should be thinking about is to what extent, and again, if there's a timing issue here, but, you know, you could actually think about if something happens on the TISA front, say, okay, we take that back to Geneva, you make that part of a bigger package deal, which would be called, of course, the Doha Development Agenda deal. So that, again, is not completely off the table, at least it's feasible. So on the minuses, I've already mentioned, you know, we only have a subset of countries writing the rules, and that's really, I think, is a big question, whether countries will be willing to accept those rules, but at the same time, I think there's an even bigger question as to what those rules are going to look like, right? And again, that's something that she also mentioned, and personally, I don't expect there to be a whole lot of groundbreaking in terms of really binding new rules that would really change the way that governments regulate and the way they do business. So just some simple tests, questions to ask. There's been an ongoing process now for almost 20 years to try and agree on what kind of discipline should be imposed on domestic regulation of services. Right in the gas, through a working party, a working group on domestic regulation that's been focused on professional services. There was a deal done on accountancy in 1998, which has yet to be adopted because it was linked to the conclusion of the Doha round. And the big fight there is, and there haven't been any progress because a lot of countries are refusing or have a lot of resistance to adopting a necessity test. Right, so essentially the notion being that you should be able to justify domestic regulation as being the least trade restrictive, or that regulation, whatever is put in place, actually should, if there is a negative trade effect, that should be necessary, right? So you shouldn't be imposing unnecessary barriers to trade. They have not been able to agree on that in 20 years, so I think one of the tests for TISA is if you're really serious about liberalizing traded services, and you are really good friends of services, well, what are you going to do on the necessity test side? Now, my prediction is nothing is going to happen on that because the US doesn't want it. The EU hasn't put it in any of its recent preferential trade agreements. But again, I think that's a signal that TISA is not all that, you know, isn't necessarily going to do a whole lot on the rulemaking front. Similarly with enforcement, you can ask, so what is TISA going to do to actually deal with and put in place stronger remedies? We know there's not going to be any investor state dispute settlement in TISA. At least that's what they say. So there again, I think that's a test. So if you're really serious about trying to make progress in liberalizing trade and services, you need to have mechanisms to enforce them. If there isn't much in the way of really effective enforcement mechanisms that go beyond what you can do through the WTO, I don't think we need to either worry or be particularly happy about what is going to happen in TISA. So market access, another minus, I think, in the sense for the members, because it's all going to be about locking. A lot of the sensitive sectors have been taken off the table, ex ante, not only visual, health, education, the usual suspects. But I think the key thing here, it's really all about locking, so there isn't much in the way of liberalization. Now, that lack of ambition, even though it would be a minus if I'm sitting around the table negotiating visa, might actually be a plus from a multilateralization point of view, because it is going to be a lot easier to multilateralize if we want to go down that route. But I think multilateralization obviously requires, and again, as Professor Xi mentioned, you need to go from 70 to 90, however you want to define critical mass. And critical mass is going to get defined essentially by the negotiators themselves, right? It's all about who should be there, who isn't there, and clearly China needs to be there, India needs to be there, I think Brazil needs to be there. So unless you get to that, I don't see this becoming a critical mass agreement, if there's anything of substance there. And I think this is really where it becomes kind of interesting, because if there isn't a whole lot of substance there, it doesn't really matter all that much that these countries haven't been part of the negotiation. It also should become a lot easier for those countries to join. So I think the exclusion of China is a major missed opportunity for many reasons, but at the same time, it might not be too much of a downside to bringing it back to the WTO. So just to conclude, I think it's very difficult to assess ex-ante what the impact of PISA is going to be, but we don't really know what is going to be negotiated. It's also therefore very hard to assess what the incentive effects are going to be for the countries that are out. I mentioned the lack of transparency, which I think is really a negative. At the very least, we want to have the secretariat sitting in these meetings so that they know what is going on and they can brief others. I really don't see why, even if you don't want people involved in negotiation, that you don't tell them much more about what you're actually doing or trying to do. So currently, you're really dependent on going to the websites of individual members who are participating in the negotiations. And as was mentioned there, the information is not exactly consistent, including on the number of negotiating rounds that you have. So I think the downside, though, for the trading system right now is likely to be limited, right? If only because the potential upside is also likely to be small. And I think here the thing that we need to worry about or think about is TISA is not the only game in town when it comes to liberalization and negotiation of services, right? So we have the TPP, we have TTIP, we have the other bilateral PTAs that are being negotiated by the EU and other OECD countries with each other, and all of those might be deeper and therefore divert more than you might get out of a TISA agreement. So my final kind of bullet here is where I would come down in terms of how do you think about this going forward? I think there really is an opportunity to make TISA a critical mass as part of the Doha deal. I put it here as a question mark, but I think that is something that really should be thought about, especially because it isn't all that ambitious, right? So they spent a lot of time talking about what the structure would look like and what to put in terms of the commitments, etc. But it seems to me that there, given that there isn't a whole lot there, it should be relatively easy to kind of expand the set of countries if there is a willingness to make this as part of a bigger package. Right? And if that is not possible and TISA continues on its own track, and even if it becomes an Article 5 agreement under the GATS, you know, I still don't see a whole lot of downside right now for what that would imply with the trading system. Again, given that the structure is such that you can actually bring it back to the GATS. Now that also means from the perspective of business, though, you know, they're not going to be particularly happy with anything that comes out of the TISA. So there again, I think the window is pretty small to say, let's claim success, bring it back to Geneva, make it part of the Doha deal, because, you know, if not, this train of moving down the preferential route and actually doing things in a much more serious way is just going to get stronger and stronger. And, you know, and actually there is a problem here in terms of how much you can fool the business community. This is actually worth doing. But I think certainly if you could make it part of a bigger package, then it would be worth doing. So let me stop there.
Now we have two very rich presentations. A lot of funds are on the table. So it's very interesting. Some of them are very powerful. Might be contradictory to each other. So I think that is a very important question for our discussion. Now the floor is open. Like and write comments. Please, Deborah.
Yeah, I had comments for, well, one comment, one question. On China's value of its services, you know, I think that it's highly likely, like with most countries, that you really understate the value of the services, and especially for China, because the embedded value of services in manufactured goods, I think it's quite high. We know it's quite high. I'm in this project with the Fung Global Institute, Patrick Lowe out of Hong Kong, and with the APEC Secretariat, in which we've been doing case studies, tracking the supply chains of different manufactured products, big companies, small companies, to see how much of their value is actually services, and which services are they insourced, are they in-house provided or outsourced. And our numbers are showing between 40% and 70% of the value of different manufactured goods is actually services in small companies and big companies. And I suspect that for China it's the same way. So I think that if you say China's a manufacturing company, a country, I would say no, probably it's mostly actually services, even still in its manufactured goods, because the value of services across the way is actually very high. So having China in services agreement is not just important, but rather critical both for China and for its companies, because even its manufactured goods companies are going to struggle if services are not opened up, because that's a key part of what they're delivering. And then the question that I had was actually on extending the best PTA in TISA. That strikes me as peculiar. What happens if your best PTA is all on a negative list basis? How do you do that then? So you translate it back to a positive list and then extend that? That seems a little strange to me. And then if you said, well, my best PTA and all of my best PTAs are negative lists, and we're all dealing with a lot of negotiation, not all, because the EU won't go negative, but in general, a lot of the folks at the table surely have their best PTAs are negative. That means that you can't extend a negative PTA list in TISA, which means, I guess, it's easier then to bring it back into the WTO, which is also a positive list. But I find that a bit odd. Like, if I were asked my best negative list, my best PTA would probably be negative. I mean, it doesn't have to be, but usually in practice. So how do they handle that?
Thank you. Please.
Well, I have a short comment. Actually, I think PTA is more or less a European preferential treatment given to developing countries. And it's a good model that Professor Hartman told that it has a vast networking, and it's good if all the members can have a space for negotiation, because it includes already quite a lot of members. But the problem is that a treatment, if you require a reciprocal treatment for the developing countries, then you have some obstacles. And how is the package that the developing countries can offer to developed countries like European Union or America, right? So there was a technical problem that how to balance the interest. I mean, and the model is quite an idea, because you have already a base there, and you have a lot of members already there, and just include China, India, and the US together, it would be very efficient. But the problem is, again, the balance of interest in this model. So this is my short point.
That is some back to the first presentation, Professor Hollis' presentation. It's nice to see again the history, to remember all the issues. One point and a comment. One point that is missing in your presentation is that you have another kind of flexibility behind the number negotiation. That's not only sectors, but remember the special products. All countries could have as far as I can remember 15% of the whole list that they can be more flexible than to use the cuts. So you have a lot of flexibility on this. That is 15% of the whole list of NAMA. There's another flexibility for you to use and to discuss. And I think that if you can have 15% of the list of the frauds, perhaps more easy to do, will be easy to do than your sectorials. You choose two sectorials that I can advance, that will be quite satisfying to do, for that, because machinery and chemistry is probably the most sensitive issue to liberalize. So try to play with the idea of the list of activities with the list of sensitive issues. I try to find out my essentially because I don't think that sectorials is easy to revive again.
Thank you.
Yes. Well, I had just one comment, and before I do so, I have to admit that I'm not a serious expert. In my previous job, when I was working for Ambassador Sen, I have done more or less touched upon every WTO subject except services. But I have followed it in a general term, so I'm not going to comment on the specifics. Just one question, I think a lot of people have asked about the question, how to get China in. I mean, some people, those insiders, I mean, participants of TSAF say that they have basically have two options. So they have, first they came to China, and they say that, well, you have to show us whether you are on board of the same level of ambition of other participants. And, I think in our letter to apply for participation in the TISA, it basically says that we're going to be on board of the level of ambition there. It's not the exact word, but it's something like what you can do, we are going to do it. But that's going to be done through negotiation. And but they just want China to demonstrate by actual kind of pre-negotiation before you are even allowed in. Show us your cards, the cards in your pockets. I think it will be is a mission impossible. Think about that. This is purely naive to think even that MOFCOM could. Go to other ministries, telecommunications, banking, and just tell them that we have to show them we have communities here, and there before we are allowed in. What would happen? They would just pocket and ask for more. That's natural response from other ministry, I'm sure of that. So that's something naive. I don't think it's going to happen. And then the other option, some of the participants, they have more or less publicly say that, well, let's do ourselves. Let's clean the table, make the dinner ready, and then invite China in. No, I don't think that's going to happen. Because it's not like the same story, and it's not the same situation. And for China, it's not the same mindset as when we negotiate WTO accession. Both political and economic circumstances have totally changed. So China is not going to just wait you guys there, finish the negotiation, and say, come in, here's dinner. You have the U.S. McDonald's, you have the French cheese, and then, so China, you just take them and pay us. No, we don't have Chinese noodles here, so I don't think it will be feasible that for China. And another reason behind this is that the TISA is not the only place where service rules are going to be made. And China, if you look at some of the recent FTA agreements China has concluded with other countries like Switzerland and others, you will see that the service part is coming higher, not like in previous FTAs. Service has been downgraded to a certain extent. So actually, those are the places China definitely would go to RCEP, and other places China definitely could test the further liberalization of our own services. So I think that either you let China in now, or you forget about China in the future. That's my personal observation, of course. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairman. Please. I have a question for Professor Buddha. In the context of the NAMA negotiations, an issue which used to be
a lot of times when the modalities were being discussed was the preference erosion for the least developed countries in the context of now. Particularly if the Swiss formulas were adopted in the sharp cuts and what would happen. On the other hand, in markets where LDCs were not getting zero tariff, in markets where they were getting zero tariff, there were differential impact with regard to the non-negotiation. So there are any new developments with regard to that. And Professor Xi, you mentioned about five reasons why the U.S. wouldn't get infection. What are those reasons you didn't mention? I was interested to know that. And Bernard, in many of the RTAs in our region, for example, in SAR, you know, we have the SAR cut. We are now negotiating the South Asian Trade in Services. And also in the BIMSTEC, of which also we are members, the BIMSTEC Services Agreement is being negotiated. So how does all this, in the bigger picture of scheme of things, how does these RTAs and the services negotiations fit into the broader picture of the services negotiation? Thank you.
So as before we go to Peter and Mr. Potter, I want to ask, anyone who wants to make comment about the U.S. position or U.S. strategy on TISA? I think that from the broader context. Okay, so is there any new strategy or trade strategy from the United States after the global financial crisis of 2008? And on the other hand, on the fact of China, why are the driving forces behind why China wanted to join the TISA? The pro-level negotiations. Right. So I think that is a very interesting question. So we can have more thought on this. Peter, please.
Thanks, Johan. I'm not sure I'm going to answer your question. But just on China's logic, I mean, I do think it makes perfect sense in terms of China's domestic reform strategy. All the emphasis on services, to want to join one of the main games in town. It's not the only game in town. And that also explains the growing interest, I think, as you put it, in the TPP particularly. So as an extension of domestic reform strategy, it makes a lot of sense. I would just observe, and I wanted to make this observation in the context of both services and NAMA, since both are on the table, that South Africa is going in a different direction. So if I look at services, for example, the argument being made is that we gave a lot in the Uruguay round. Our services sector was already pretty open. But in actual fact, for domestic political reasons, in certain services sectors, the argument is we need to roll back some of that liberalization. And there is going to be, I think, a concrete example of that fairly soon, which has to do with the private security industry. Europe around, essentially, South Africa left that sector open. No restrictions on ownership particularly, but there are now proposals coming out of the African National Congress to essentially take away the shares of foreign private-owned companies in the private security industry. And the government has already said that they're going to go to the GATS committee and ask for that commitment to be withdrawn and then to negotiate compensation. So in terms of getting the S of the BRICS into TISA, I think that is not likely to happen. In fact, what I expect to be more likely is that this logic of restricting foreign ownership is likely to be rolled out in other services sectors as well as non-services sectors. So in a sense, we're going the opposite direction to China. We're going to where you're coming from, which personally I don't agree with, but that is the way things are going. Which then brings me to this issue of the value of bindings. Because I think and I understand why people were saying this, but Bernard and Dick were quite dismissive in the sense of the value of bindings. But when I think about it from the point of view of where our policy is going, both on tariffs as well as on services, we're rolling back commitments. So we've raised tariffs, for instance, in the poultry sector. The US is pretty concerned about this in the context of the Doha negotiations, amongst other countries. We roll back tariffs in the clothing sector, so basically push them back up to binding levels. And similarly on services now, we're starting to roll back on previous bindings and previous liberalisation. If I put that into a broader context, if one thinks of the US farm bill that was recently passed through Congress, we had a lot of discussion about this in Brazil. Imagine if the Doha round had been concluded, particularly the agriculture package and the subsidies disciplines, would you see a farm bill like you now have? I don't think so. So the value of bindings, I think, should not be underestimated. There's another point related to that, which gets to the lack of interest of the business community. So one can understand, if I were a business person, frankly, my eyeballs would glaze over if you mentioned the Doha round or pretty much most trade negotiations these days, it seems to me. But I think we shouldn't bemoan that fact. We shouldn't spend too much time on it. Really, it's the role of governments to lead, it seems to me. And if the business community is not coming to the party, well, you know, government's role is to lead. You have to advance. You can't wait for the private sector to come on board. So maybe it's just because in the South African case we don't have strong offensive export interests. So government leads anyway by default and attempts to drag the private sector along with it. Now in the wrong direction, because I guess I'm more reflecting on our history. And I also wanted to make a point about the less than full reciprocity issue in the NAMA negotiations. But the argument coming out of the South African side is that based on the formulas that are currently on the table, South Africa would pay more than full reciprocity because the gap between bound and applied tariffs in our case is very small. And we're getting very little on the agriculture side. The European Union, the US would maintain their subsidies. There's lots of carve-outs in the agricultural tariffs area. We would have to apply this relatively ambitious tariff formula. And effectively the result would be more than full reciprocity under the NAMA negotiations. Okay, so now whether you agree with that or not, that's the government's position. But it makes me think that there's very little chance that the South African government, or I suspect the Indian government, would sign up to Professor Horder's suggestion, which I thought was a very constructive suggestion, but realistically or practically, I think there's very little chance of at least the S and the I in the BRICS actually signing up to it. So I'm not sure what prospects it has. Yeah, maybe just one final point on Dick's observation. It's every country's right not to accept what's on the table. But I think, I've been informally testing this with a few people around the table. In light of what's happened with the AIIB issue, the US being isolated, essentially, on the geopolitical stage. The fact that the US won't accept what's on the table, I think it's just a matter of time. It may be a long time, but it's just a matter of time before countries effectively go around the US. Now, I don't know when Washington will come to that realization, Dick, but hopefully it will come to it and take it seriously.
Thank you, Peter. Professor Hodder?
I was trying to understand the points that have been made both by Dr. Shi and Bernard. About the whole objective being in the TISA negotiations to lock in the current level of access, which is something like the applied level of tariffs. I was trying to understand the logic of those countries who in the Nama area say that the current level is of no interest to us. And here they are trying, and that is their only objective. Having said this, I can say that as far as my knowledge of tariff negotiations, tariff component of PTA is concerned, there also the whole idea has been to capture the current level of very minor differences, which is always puzzling me as to what the whole idea was in the PTA, the services component of the regional agreements, to just bind something, and that also at a lower level than the applied level. So this is the first sort of question that I have to anyone who might like to answer this, as to why this objective has been so unambitious in the TISA negotiation, when they have broken away from the main group on the belief in the expectation that they'll do something more about liberalization of services. That's my first observation. One question I have is on the rulemaking side. In the multilateral negotiations in Doha round, in two of the areas, well, government procurement is slightly on a different footing, but two of the areas, services and subsidies, the position taken by some of the developed countries is that in subsidies, that is the position, that there is no problem of subsidies, so in services there. So why look for a solution when the problem is missing? That's the main argument that at least the United States has given very, very eloquently, saying that why should the problem chase the solution? If there is no problem, then we should sort of look for a solution. So what exactly has been, if Bernard or Dr. Shi has knowledge of this, what exactly has been the thinking in the negotiations on this aspect? Is there a problem in subsidies? For this they need to develop a discipline. And similarly, on the safeguards, emergency safeguards. In the TPA, in the Doha round, there is sort of total lack of willingness to talk about this subject among the developed countries. Whereas some countries, particularly the ASEAN, have been pursuing it very vigorously. Now, I wanted to know, because I have not been following these news, these are not in the public domain, and I think Bernard and Dr. Shi have made a special effort to find out what is happening. Is there some more light that can be thrown on the aspect of safeguards, emergency safeguards in this type of discussions? I noticed from Dr. Shi's presentation that the two are categorized slightly differently. One has a question mark and the other has a cross. So whatever that means, maybe you can tell me something. Did you put a question to me on
the preference erosion concern?
On the
preference erosion concern in the context of the NAMA for dailies.
Yeah, I just checked out, actually in the NAMA chairs thing, there is some suggestion about alleviating the difficulties of those countries. The non-preference, the preference, non-reciprocal preference is the same country. But when I checked it more carefully when you raised the question, I don't think that is applicable to the least developed country. So I'm sorry if I misread that. And I think, Vera, you raised some points regarding Nama.
Special products, the list of special products.
Well, there is no special products in the Nama. The special products...
No, it is. It's a sensitive product.
Yeah, it's a sensitive product. Yeah. It's a sensitive product.
Sensitive product.
Sensitive. Arose by any
other name. Any country can have a list. I can... 50, I talked to Durna during this.
I thought that what it has is that there is a certain permission that the developing countries want to exclude.
That's it, that's the same problem.
But that, they don't have a list.
Each country will choose.
Yeah.
Each country will choose the list they want.
That's right.
Yeah, it's self-testing.
So there is no list. And they only say that they should have the flexibility mm-hmm.
yeah.
to exclude or to lower. There's no list of yet. I mentioned in the morning that personally I do not support this because it doesn't make economic good sense. The tariffs are being reduced.
Professor, I raise these because if you go to the list of several countries, many of the sectors that you propose, the sectors, you include these sensitive products. That's the point. The products inside your sectors are exactly the products that are sensitive for majority of the developing countries. That's the point.
All right. So there's no question to me, so I won't. Thank you.
Thank you. Maybe Chen Xia or Bernard would like to make a minute response to the questions from comments from Mr. Hoda.
Go ahead. I think I'll give the floor to Professor.
Okay. So on this question of best PTA, this is kind of the, what shall I call it, the marketing, the vision, call it the vision. This is what was bandied about when they started to think about what they were trying to do. If you look at what they're actually doing, I think we're going to be pretty far away from the best PTA, because the best PTA for the EU, of course, is the European Union, which is not going to happen anytime soon for anyone else. So I think how they are going to actually do that is, I think it's a very good question. It's an open question. But I think it's one reason why they went and made this decision that market access was going to be positive in the visa compact. So at least there you can manage this and the negative list in terms of the national treatment approach. And I think there's going to be a fair amount of touching depending on how these PTAs actually are. So I think that is something which is remains to be seen. And clearly some of these sectors where this would be very sensitive have been taken off the table. Get-go. And there again, in some PPAs, they are covered, whereas they're not going to be covered in visa. So again, it remains to be seen. I think the point that was made on, you know, visa not being the only game in town, and that there's lots of preferential trade agreements covering services all over the world, to a greater or lesser extent. But I think that really does give rise to a coherence problem in terms of how you actually go about designing these agreements. And that, of course, was one of the things that they have to deal with when they started talking TISA, because the US has a very different approach from the EU in terms of scheduling the whole structure of these agreements. So I think simply because the TISA negotiators went a particular direction doesn't remove that problem, because we still have all of those PTAs. So in a sense, it goes back to Debbie's question, how do you actually make these things more coherent is still very much an open question. I think one thing we talked, I guess Peter talked about it a little bit, but I think one thing that I guess is important to bear in mind. So if you take the case of China, for example, where services are much more centrally part
of the strategy, the growth strategy looking forward, clearly the agenda is very much a unilateral agenda. Right? So I think here the question to ask, which I certainly should have discussed, I mean, is to what extent is a TISA type of an approach or any other preferential type of an approach going to actually help the country get to where the country wants to be? Right? And I think that's, again, looking from what is actually embedded in some of these agreements, I think there's going to be lots of holes, loopholes, things where you actually need to do a lot more for yourself than anything you would probably write into an agreement. So I think this unilateral dimension is an important part of the equation. Peter's point on binding, it's not that I don't think binding is unimportant, right? So I think actually that is something which I've in the past argued very unpersuasively, that even if Doha doesn't generate much in the way of liberalization, the fact that you're binding a lot more tariffs, that you're binding a lot more service commitments, that really is a large part of what the institution is all about. And people who think that in past negotiating rounds was a huge amount of real liberalization that happened as the outcome of the negotiations, you know, are really not getting what the institution actually does, which is it is all about binding. And yes, there is some liberalization over time, but to a large extent, the rounds are actually locking in liberalization as occurred in the period between the rounds, and that's really what it's all about. So I think your examples of South Africa are spot on, the Farm Bill, same story, and I think that's certainly also something we're getting out of the economic literature, right? So if you read the empirical economic literature that tries to actually identify what the value of binding is, you know, which is still a pretty small set of people working on this, but they find very, you know, statistically significant effects in terms of this actually has value, both in reducing uncertainty, but also in terms of the risk premium that are associated with investment and so forth. So these things really, also you can actually pick this up in the data that there is a positive effect of binding.
Could I interject something there? Because I agree with you. But you should know there's a feeling at USTR, and many of the people at USTR, of sort of loss of faith in bindings. Loss of faith in the sense that they believe that countries who really feel that they need to get their barriers or their tariffs or whatever up or evade the restrictions are going, for these days, more and more going to find a way to do it. And they point to India's power play to get the relieved of the restrictions on the agricultural sector, on the food security subsidy and the procurement program, stockpiling program. They refer to Argentina, which appears to have adopted a policy of when they want to kick up their tariffs above the bindings, they do so and figure, well, you're going to bring a dispute settlement case against us, and that's going to take you a couple of years, and by that time the need for the evasion of bindings will have passed, and we'll just say, okay, well, we lost, and we'll cave in. My view on that, frankly, is that may show a sort of a weakening of the ethos of the system, and that's a sign that shows that we really need new leadership in the WTO system of people who are expressing faith in the system through negotiation and otherwise. And I think the fact that the U.S. and the developed countries are viewed as having moved away from the system in negotiations tends to produce the kind of scofflaw reaction that USTR sees in some of these countries, and the appropriate reaction to that is not to say, well, okay, bindings don't matter much anymore. The appropriate reaction is, how do we reinforce the strength of the system?
Dick, if I could cut in that, I have heard a lot from the U.S. representatives when they talk about when they try to do dilute the significance of the water and the binding. But on the other hand, when we talk about ag subsidies and for them, It's conflicting because they always say for us, a lot of studies have demonstrated that whatever US and EU they are going to commit on accepting, that's not going to come down to the applied level. Right. And for them, they say that means a lot already. That's serious, substantial concessions we have made. So it's a conflicting real points from their.
The great American author Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "A foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds."
on your India Argentina examples, fine. But let's go back to the 1970s. Go back to the 1980s. So I think they need to kind of bear in mind where we're coming from. And this is all incremental progress over a long period of time. So the people, you know, I think there's also this dimension which people in USTR don't seem to recognize enough, is that we have Argentina, and Argentina has been Argentina for well over a century, right? So I don't think Argentina is the, you know, they have lots of other big problems, macroeconomic problems, which leads them almost inevitably to do what they do in our trade policy. So I think they're a bit of a special case. India has been doing what India has been doing for many, many, many years, and I think it's improved dramatically. Right? I mean, if you compare Indian trade policy today and the extent to which they live up to the rules compared to what they used to do, I mean, we're living in a different world. So I think that's part of, you know, whether that's part of the commitment, legally or not, but I think part of the issue here is you're giving people in ministries of commerce the ammunition to actually say no to a lot of lobbying for things that they don't have to do. And that's another dimension of why the system is actually important. So I just want to pick up on Anurag's question on the lock-in. So partly the lock-in is what we've been talking about here now. So lock-in and the services subsidies issues. Now, what it is on subsidies, I don't know how many of you probably have seen this survey that was... So the European Union does these surveys of business, civil society, anybody who is interested can respond to these things every time they do a negotiation. So there was one done for TISA, which is actually very interesting on subsidies because, and they actually point this out quite explicitly, they say everybody complained about everything under the sun except subsidies. Right? So nobody raised the subsidy issue, whether it's civil society, business, whomever. There was one instance, one respondent that mentioned the word subsidies across the whole European Union. So, you know, I found that very surprising myself. But I think there is this sense that subsidies maybe are not all that much of a big deal. Now, of course, the other dimension is everybody's doing it, right? And a large amount of what the subsidies that goes on in services really have to do with market failures, with public provision of things, etc. So I think that might be another element where governments are not going to be all that inclined to go after each other very fast. But what really struck me is that business apparently doesn't see this as something they worry about, as opposed to domestic regulation, as opposed to licensing, qualifications, and all those types of things. And then on safeguards, I think, I used to think that the reason we didn't really need safeguards in the services context was one, because the GATS didn't really do any liberalization, so, you know, you don't really need to think about safeguards immediately, which is why they shut it down the road, but you also have the issue of once you have liberalized something, and given that a lot of the liberalization and the provision of services is going to happen through foreign direct investment, what are you going to do? Throw those guys out? Or tax the foreign supplier and subsidize the domestic supplier, and all of them are creating domestic employment? So it becomes a bit bizarre to think about how we actually would do safeguards in the services context once you recognize that a lot of this actually goes through investment. And then at the end of the day, given that there are no subsidy disciplines, if you really want to help a domestic industry, you know, you can always pay them. Again, I don't know how much that is apart from parcel of the thinking of people, but in principle, the instrument is there. So there might be a link there between safeguards and subsidies. But then again, nobody seems worried about subsidies.
Oh, thank you.
I think I have four or five points to respond. Firstly, I think Professor Deborah Elms is quite insightful in noting the importance of services embedded in goods.
Actually, if you note, there is a new paper published in the Journal of World Trade. Some scholars pointed this as Model 5 supply of services, in addition to, you know, the traditional gas forms of service supply. And some Sweden scholars, early in, I believe in 2008, already raised the concept of so-called servicification of manufacturing industry. Also, if you look at from the interaction between global value chain or supply chain and trading services, you do find there is more and more percentage of services in world trade in the form of embedded goods. I know Patrick Lowe's project because it's co-elaborated with one of my friends. I think they are also thinking about to choose some Chinese enterprises as example. You are quite right. You're noting in the trade of Chinese enterprises, services account more and more percentage. For example, in Huawei, the manufacturing of my cell phone. Traditionally, Huawei is categorized as a manufacturer of communication equipment. But Huawei has been noting in recent years, as they told me, their profits, more and more percentage of their profits come from services instead of goods in recent years. Services, you know, include several, many kinds, including like designing services, after sales services, and, you know, also they provide maintenance services for large integrated communication system. So it's I believe more and more Chinese enterprises having been recognizing this trend, and they recognizing the importance of trading services played in China's transformation to a leading power in global economy. So that's my first response. And second, I note that Professor Wang and Chair Wang raised a question: why does China want to join TISA negotiation? I think the reason can be simple and easily understood, at least from two aspects. The first one, as I emphasized in my presentation, services industry and the services trade played a very important role in recent decades, particularly from 2005 until now, one whole decade. A very important role in upgrading Chinese economy in its so-called new normal era. That's one reason. The second reason I believe is that China, unlike previous status, China now is eager to participate in rule-setting process. I think this can act as one of symbol of China's soft power. China does not only satisfy, you know, its economic performance, but also, you know, some kind of soft power manifestation. Rather than, you know, everything is decided by other countries, and China has to join finally with paying extra cost, just as China did many years ago in accepting WTO. China now is eager to participate in the process of setting the international rules, consider in economic area, economic and trade area. This brings up to my third response to Professor Lu, the question how to bring China in the TISA negotiation. The biggest opponent now is the US and Japan, but Japan is not that important in this respect. If the US agrees China in, and I don't think that Japan will be continuing to object. So the largest barrier is the United States. I think about 1 or 2 years ago, there is one idea that combining China's BIT deal with TISA negotiation, but apparently now China lost this opportunity, because now you can see BIT between China and the US, the negotiation is being conducted relatively smoothly. So now it's less likely that China to realize this idea. I think the only way is to persuade the US to agree, but as I have been experiencing, you know, I had some talk with the official in USTR in charge of TISA negotiation. It's very hard, at least now, because the biggest concern for the US is that if China is there, the whole negotiation probably will become the fight between the US and China. So it will, you know, still lead the awkward situation of DDA. That's a concern as the US side. And the US emphasized that China is not ready for the TISA negotiation. But as I asked the question, you know, whether China is ready for the TISA negotiation, if it's completely up to the US, that's not fair. But now it's the situation, because it's subject to the US to agree China. So that's the situation. It's very awkward, you know.
Could I suggest one thing on that?
Please.
The head of the U.S. Services Coalition is now Peter Allgaier.
Yeah.
Peter Allgaier, former deputy USTR Geneva. Peter is probably one of the more reasonable people to come out of USTR.
I had a talk with Peter,
and
not actually.
A real hawk, but yeah. Not an anti-China hawk. And the industry, dialogue on TISA might be productive.
But Peter actually also recognized, you know, it's very controversial. It's very hard. Even for the coalition, it's hard for the coalition of services industry to persuade the USTI, the negotiator in charge of the negotiation, to think that China is already ready for the TISA negotiation. I don't know how to persuade the U.S., frankly speaking. This brings up another question put forward by Ms. Ryman. You note that I mentioned five reasons. Actually, you know, I have I'm in a bad state today, so I can only think about four reasons. I forget the last one. Okay. At least I think I thought about four reasons that the U.S. raised opposing China joining the TISA negotiation. The first one is that China's performance in the negotiation of ITA. Second, China's implementation of, you know, the WTO BS 413, that's China UPS, electronic payment services pay. It seems that the US is not satisfactory with China's implementation of this, the regulation by the DSB in this case. The third reason is the China's negotiation in joining the GPA, government procurement agreement, not satisfactory for the US as well. The last reason I can figure out now is that China, the US think China's services market is huge, but many of services sector are controlled by, you know, some large state-owned companies, enterprises like financial services, telecommunication services, which, you know, accounts the number one and the number two services sector in terms of trade volume. The fifth reason probably it's about China's RTA's commitment in services area, but I'm not very sure. So that's a,
I think it's the bit.
Yeah, China's the performance in BIT negotiation with the US. Yeah. That's
the
longer
list.
If I would guess.
Yeah, I think you are right. So altogether that there are five reasons. But if you think carefully about each reason, I cannot agree with the US, you know, the perspective that China is not ready. I think to some extent whether China is ready for the negotiation, at least to some extent is up to China, not completely, you know, up to the US. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr.
Shu. I think according to our schedule, we still have some time, and if you'd like to make more comments and questions, please do so. I echo in this one point from Mr. Honda, Dr. Shu. I think that is TISA. I think that it might be, it can be perceived as a part of the stories. That is a competition for the rule setting. People talking about mega regional FTA like TPP, TTAP, combined with the TISA. Right? They are for the future, so-called 21st century, the higher standard. So I think that is, I think there's some people talk about, it might be you know, the anti-China or target China or the other emerging economies. But personally, I think that might be the strategy of negotiations. How to ensure that okay, the countries like the United States is sustain a more advantageous positions in the negotiation over the teams. Mm-hmm. I think Dick mentioned your friend, Peter, a reasonable person.
Right.
Yeah, I think that is, but it's how to the balance, the reasonable, and there is a thinking about the strategies. So I think I want to ask her for your advice on the relationship between the business community, especially the service industry association, for example, right. CITES, and the U.S. government positions on TISA. Okay. So if Dr. Xu, based on her interview, he made one point, I think very interesting, right? He said even the business community, the service sector, were not able to convince the US government to accept China.
But according to Peter, the president of CSI, not every US enterprise, you know, even there are some different views among
right,
US enterprises.
Right, definitely. So I think that is my understanding from the perspective of the trade politics, right, about my understanding about the US trade politics. And the US government positions usually follow the will of interests of the business community, especially the big companies, they're not the operate. So I want to ask for your advice on that.
There's a long history of the services industries in the United States being leaders in globalization and in multilateral trade negotiations. They were a major force in the Uruguay round. We went through a period where CSI, the Coalition of Service Industries, had, should we say, much diminished leadership as people, the head of American Express retired, another major player from in the insurance industry went to jail, but I think there is now, you're seeing a bit of a cycle on that. I guess my sort of feeling on this is that services are moving as rapidly toward global value chains as our manufacturing industries. That links in global value chains between Chinese service companies and U.S. service companies are already proliferating. I'm not sure that China has given enough thought to how those links can be exploited, played upon to persuade the U.S. To move the feeling of the U.S. services business community more in favor of China coming into the talks. The U.S. services industry doesn't have the sort of ideological predisposition that the U.S. government has about China. And I don't want to overplay that, because there's the trade people of the U.S. government aren't the major source of the problem in terms of U.S.-China relations. It is the geopolitical people and, to a lesser extent, the financial people. And the financial people normally are the Treasury Department, normally the liberal part in terms of trade and globalization in the U.S. government. However, as you can see by the latest fiasco on the U.S. position on the IAB, the Treasury Department has sort of moved into the other camp. But the business community in services doesn't have a geopolitical axe to grind the way that the government does. And I would try to use that more, try to get those relationships going better more. One of the problems that you have in general with the United States is that you have a U.S. Trade Representative who is A, very smart, but B, comes from a geopolitical background. And he sees all of this with a geopolitical overlay. And the business community input is really important on any specific issue in sort of moving the needle in terms of both USTR sentiment and the White House's sentiment. In terms of specific arguments to make, boy, I can't really see. It's hard for me to see an economic concern about having China into the TISA talks, particularly the way you describe the TISA talks, which is these are not setting massive new rules. These are basically lock-ins. Mm-hmm. That being the case, what's the problem with having China in? Case that's made against China in some of these areas is you want to set our rules before China sets their rules. If that's not really what TISA is all about, then the opposition should be less, and the business community could well help offset that. So that's a little rambling and a little inarticulate, but then again, that's me. But that would be sort of my thought. I'd like to give some more thought to it, too.
Thank you very much, Dick. I think that is very helpful for us to understand the policy process. So about the China part, so I think we'll be very short on this from my point. Say the China really wants to join TISA talks. Right, so do you think there is a good strategy or a good tactics to link the BIT and the membership in TISA? Now, see, you assume that you have done with the influence by the top leaders, right? Mm-hmm. BIT has moved quite smoothly. Mm-hmm. Now has entered the final stage. That is entered to exchange. There's an active list between the two governments. So I think that is a very important point. And President Xi will visit Washington in September. Yeah, so I think I will give more momentum to the negotiation over BIT. So I think that is, of course, we, as the professor mentioned that, we need a better coordination inside China to the build more pressure. So I think that to be realistic, dealing with the U.S. trade politics, you have to say the people in Washington feel some pressure. And then they will have the right reasons to show that people, as you mentioned that, that is the hardliners, all these have deep security concerns about China. So I think that is something. So I think I want to ask for your quick comment on this.
One other thought I might add on that. I'd like to know, in answering that question, I would like to know more about where in the U.S. services business community are the ones that are resistant to China-centric. It strikes me that the service areas that would look to China for elements of their global value chain would probably be quite supportive. The ones that would likely be resistant would be the ones who would look at their relationship with China primarily from the standpoint of them having an operating presence in China doing business and would have fear that China would favor domestic monopolies or domestic state-owned enterprises or domestically favored companies of some sort or another. And if that hypothesis were correct, one of the things that you might consider is to find ways to show those one or two major companies in that part of the U.S. service sector that, in fact, China is willing to accept them on a non-discriminatory basis, not impose barriers and that sort of thing, and have links between them and Chinese companies in the same industry, that sort of stuff. But I do a lot of formulating strategies. I need to know more to formulate the strategy than I know now.
It seems to me, though, that your challenge that you face is that the services industries as a whole are the only sector of the U.S. economy where unions are gaining strength. So one of the challenges you face in a purely U.S. domestic context is that you're asking unions, which are already feeling battered and under threat, which are hyper-mobilized around TPP, to now turn around and allow China to join a services agreement in the sector where U.S. unions are growing. That, I think, is your challenge. It has nothing to do with whether you're going to have real competition, not real competition, whether TISA is helpful, not helpful. It's been sold as, I should say, TISA has been sold as being this fabulous thing that is going to give all sorts of opportunities. So now to turn around and say, well, actually, it didn't really do anything is going to be tough. That argument is probably not going to be made. So I think the big battleground is trying to get the service, if you want to talk about why Peter's organization can't support it, it's because, I would think, I have no idea, I haven't talked to them, but I would think it's because if I headed the coalition of services industries, those are my union folks who are already fighting a battle in lots of other areas, they are not going to want to fight it on Tuesday. So then you have to do something about how And this would be tough, right? It's not about Chinese entry into the U.S. market. It's about giving U.S. an opportunity to export. And you have to keep the battle focused outward from the U.S. perspective, and that's not easy.
Thank you very much.
Professor?
Yeah, thank you. I just have two quick words because on this TISA, I think that we have been blaming the US enough. Another thing which when Dick mentioned about how China should engage the major service industries in the US, that struck me. Because I think on our side, we also need to do something. Not necessarily showing our cards already to the TISA participants before we are in the negotiation. But I think there are two things which, one thing is actually what Ambassador Sun at the opening intervention, he mentioned about the need to have a kind of more senior level of coordination in China's government at the State Council level. The reason is because that what the U.S. want most, I think Dr. Shi has put on her PPT some of the key sectors most important for U.S., finance, telecommunication, and those are the hardcore industries in China. And those, to be frank with you, those are the departments or ministries are not going to listen to whatever my former minister, the Minister of Commerce, is going to say. And looking at the political structure of China's central government, MOFCOM ranks, I think, something like 26 among 30 or so. And others are all above him, actually. So MOFCOM has a central role to coordinate, but is very, how to say, disadvantaged in terms of political significance. And if we, the historical lesson we have learned is actually, if you we go back to the WTO accession negotiations. The thing is that at that moment we call it a working group for WTO accession negotiations. And that was always headed by a vice premier level official. And who oversees all kinds of different ministries and he or she, Madame Wei was actually the last one. And she has all the heavy political and heavy weight as well as economic sense to know where China should make concessions and when we should insist. And at the final stage, Premier Zhu Rongji stepped into the negotiating room with some Ambassador Barashevsky. You remember that?
Yeah.
So I mean that...
Those two women had a great relationship.
Yeah, for sure. Real sometimes.
Well, whatever.
No, and also another thing why this is important is because China's political system is never bottom up. It's never that we think tank think is important and the government desk office think is important and it goes from there to the minister and minister there. No. If you look at it very carefully, like services, you look carefully. Before Premier Li Keqiang speaks about the importance of service sector to upgrade China's economy as a new driving engine for China's future growth and so on and so forth. You have heard little about all other ministers in charge of telecommunications, banking, saying that they are open to even think about liberalizing. Remember that. And afterwards, I think if you look at carefully their talk, they began to fine-tune their kind of public interventions towards the what Premier Li Keqiang has said. So I think that a kind of top-down kind of engagement from the top to help coordinate and to give more support to MOFCOM is going to be the key. And second thing, I think Dick was perfectly right in saying that China... Chinese government is never good at public communication. And many things have proved that, and we are still learning. And we, only until recently, yes, we don't have a spokesman in each ministry, you remember that. And so I mean that Ambassador Sun said that in China's, almost 15 years ago, and then when U.S. discussed about the MFA right for China. There was a lot of support from the U.S. industry. But to be frank, that was not because China has engaged them. It's because they think, the industry thought that if China is given that, and then they would benefit a lot from that. But now I think that the China should do a lot to engage not only the industry, but also the US Congress, others, and the European Parliament now. European Parliament also is playing a more important role in economic policy formulation. So all the things are not there from, I mean, our part. So I think that will be very important in the future.
Just be real careful about engaging the US Congress. That's a dark part. you really need some hand-holding and some special advice and all that. That way is a quicksand.
You're offering a discount?
Okay, I think the time is up. I would like to, if any final words from the two panelists.
Okay.
Before we wrap up.
Thanks for the precious opportunity. I have further two further comments. The first one relates to the U.S. strategy in negotiating economic and trade rules, particularly with China. I would like to draw your attention to think about more comprehensively about the U.S. strategy. As I mentioned, the possibility of linking the TISA negotiation with BIT negotiation with between U.S. and China. So I think for the TISA negotiation, the U.S. doesn't want China in because, you know, for market access commitment, U.S. does not need China there. Why? Because of BIT negotiation. If you understand this from the perspective of the close relationship between services trade and investment, you will understand what I mean. Particularly because of Mode 3. So it seems to me that the U.S. is using BIT to open China's market, including services market, using BIT. So it doesn't need China. If China, that caused a lot of concern, as I previously mentioned. For the rule set, so that's why for the rule setting, the U.S. is apparently leading the TISA negotiation, although you play some role in some aspect, but apparently U.S. is leading the negotiation. So for the rule setting, I respectfully or humbly disagree a little bit with Professor Hockman. Sorry, but after I consult a lot of materials publicly available, I found for the rule setting, the TISA, at least the TISA is trying to do a lot of things. Not only, you know, if you look at the market access commitment, probably you can say, okay, it's a lobbying commitment, but considering a new rule setting, the TISA are a lot of very important topic nowadays for the contemporary global economy, like cross-border data flow, e-commerce, and such very important topics. The TISA is trying to set rules in this area. So that again demonstrates why the U.S. does not want China. And China, I think, lost the opportunity of link BIT negotiation with TISA. If China did so, it should have been done earlier, at least before China agreed to negotiate BIT with the U.S. on the negative list and pre-emption national treatment. So now, you know, the BIT negotiation already finished the past negotiation. Now it entered the phase of scattering negative list. So I don't think that China has a lot of weight to again link these two deals together. So my observation is that China, compared to the US, China is the less experienced player in global arena, particularly in the area of economic and trade. Frankly speaking, I think China has a lot to be desired in this kind of negotiation. It lacks a view from more comprehensive plan to do something. I actually have a quick question. I'm wondering whether anyone here can answer. To what extent do you think Obama administration can get TPA from the Republicans-controlled Congress? Will Obama be another Clinton back to 1990?
No.
Because I think this to a large extent relates to the negotiation for TPP, TPIP, and TIA.
I'm not sure.
Just take
I thought I heard the name Monica Lewinsky there somewhere. In what way were you asking about, will Obama, you were asking whether he will succeed in getting TPA, or are you asking, or what? I'm missing the question. Yes.
Both. To what extent he could get TPA, and to what extent he will model what Clinton has done in the final stage of his administration. You remember. He has done quite a lot on trade.
I'll give you, all of this is pure Cunningham personal view on this. Everybody I talk to in the administration and on the Hill thinks he's got the votes for TPA. There may be compromises he has to make on some conditions that are put on TPA. My own view is that conditions put on TPA are not something that are frankly worrisome, and we can talk about that. The history of Congress putting conditions on trade negotiators is the trade negotiators come back 2 years later and say, well, we tried, but we couldn't, even though he said we absolutely have to do it, well, we couldn't. Here's the agreement. You want to reject it because we couldn't meet your conditions, and Congress says no. The question of what the broader question, I think, relates to what Obama is looking to do in the last year and a half of his administration. And my perception is Obama is fixated on his legacy. And he has certain things that he thinks are really important for that legacy. Obviously, health care was one. Immigration reform, to the extent he can do it, is another. Probably the biggest thing, single thing he will be doing now is environment. Controls, which he will be doing entirely through executive order, and there will be a huge battle between him and the Congress. But a clear portion of this is that he wants to have these two agreements, or at least one of them, in place, that is TPP and TTIP, in place before he leaves. I think he will push extremely hard on TPP. I don't think he can push as hard on TTIP. TTIP is just not, it's not amenable to that. It's this big morass with two countries that are very incompetent when negotiating with each other, and issues that are essentially regulatory in nature in ways that that are very difficult to bridge the gap. TPP, on the other hand, assuming he can get the deal done with Japan, is a doable thing. And the question, the biggest question is not whether TPP will get done. The biggest question is, can he get it ratified this year? It may have to be ratified next year, simply because of the congressional and U.S. law requirements that go into the ratification of the trade agreement. There's no more than a 50-50 chance that the vote on TPP will come up this year. And TPP, even with Trade Promotion Authority, the vote on TPP is going to be close. It'll be much closer than the vote on Trade Promotion Authority. And the reason for that is that TPP doesn't get you an awful lot of new jobs and new exports. This is why you hear him all the time talking about its geopolitical significance and all this, pardon the expression, it's a term of art in trade law, all this crap about, we've got to have our rules instead of China's rules. All of that is because he doesn't have a normal way to sell TPP. And so he has to be putting together another way to sell it. And you're going to have to put up with that for another year. My bet is, I have an immense admiration for this guy, and I think he'll get it done. Also, he benefits from the fact that he has Republicans controlling both houses of Congress. Although the Republican dynamic on this set of trade negotiation votes is a little different from what it was in the past, where 90% of the Republicans could be assumed to vote for it. You have the Tea Party that will probably vote against it because they're nativists, and you have another certain percentage, unknown how many, whose idea of how you run the Congress is to reject anything that the President wants. So it will be close. It shouldn't be close, but it will be close. And it may be next year. I don't think that the distinction between this year and next year will be all that important. It's going to be hotly politicized which in either year or two. So I don't know whether that's my opinions in response to your question. And you got to remember that aside from Obama, I've picked every losing presidential candidate in the last 20 years, and my prognostications are worth everything you just paid for them.
So there was a discount.
There was a discount.
No, that would be negative.
Thank you very much. Did any final response for benefits?
No, just on the rules business and TISA, I mean, we'll see what they come up with, but I'm a lot less hopeful than you are in terms of them actually doing something which is meaningful, partly because the US and the EU actually disagree on a lot of things that matter, including on things like data privacy, digital trade, and so forth. So that's something that's playing out in the TTIP, and that is something that is going to constrain moving forward on some of these issues in TISA as well, I expect.
Okay, so I think we'd like to wrap up for this session. Thank you for our panelists and participation of all the colleagues here. I'd like to turn the chair to Professor Tu.
And the one before it.
Yeah, I'm supposed to conclude the remarks. But I think it's even harder for me to conclude today's discussion than to conclude the Doha. So I will skip this job. Let's go to have a another wonderful dinner.
Let's go.
This is the Chinese wine.
Where are we going to download it?
I just got my name card.
Just congratulations.
Yeah, thanks a lot. It's still warm.
Good.
Yeah. So you have any?